All right. Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us tonight. I want to thank Dr. Ian Germani for organizing these terrific events and for including me as one of the speakers. I also want to take a moment to thank the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, who support my research efforts in so many ways, and my doctoral student, Samantha Horswill, who's been collaborating with me on this project. Just briefly, I think that it's very fitting that we are continuing to discuss World War I and that we are continuing to discuss soldiers. Unfortunately, it is fitting in part because we are constantly reminded that these soldiers do in fact stand for us, both on our soil and off our soil. In order to understand the immense impact of World War I on mental health, it is critical to provide some context regarding the available data on psychology, the cultural considerations surrounding mental health, and the historically available technologies that were consistent with World War I time periods. To that end, we're going to begin tonight with the Iliad and move relatively rapidly towards 1914, wherein we will slow down before proceeding rapidly again to the present day. This should provide some of the necessary context to understand at least some of the impact World War I has had on mental health. We have long documented human exposure to traumatic events, perhaps no more so than those related to war, and the changes that occur to people as a result. The Iliad may be the earliest such documentation where the effects of war were documented to dramatically have changed the heart of Achilles. We have similarly long documented ailments of behavior or personhood, with Hippocrates first identifying these ailments, behavior changes, if you will, and complicated symptom reports from women, all of which he attributed to disturbances of the uterus. The term hysteria would eventually be used pejoratively, primarily by men against women, referring to any emotional display considered to be inappropriate. The symptoms typically included what we would call today anxiety, depression, sexual dysfunction, and/or conversion disorders. Later, Cartesian dualism would draw a stark line between mental and material substances, suggesting that the two can and must be distinguished, which led to prolific discriminations between real and imagined symptoms. One of the earliest documentations of symptoms we would eventually classify as post-traumatic stress disorder appeared in 1667 and was written by Samuel Pepys after the Great Fire of London. "I did within these 6 days still see smoke remaining of the late fire in the city, and it is strange to think how to this very day I cannot sleep a night without great terrors of fire. And this very night I could not sleep till almost 2 a.m. through the thoughts of fire." Despite the clarity of this description, it would be more than 300 years before post-traumatic stress disorder appeared as a recognized mental health disorder. Instead, the first formal description of changes to mental health following traumatic exposure would come from the French in the late 1600s. Physicians and military leaders noted that soldiers who were exposed too long to warfare would develop symptoms of melancholy and inexplicable pain, with an increased risk for subsequent suicide. Their excellent clinical notations would be largely disregarded for centuries. Indeed, notions that the mind could be medicalized did not become formalized until psychiatry was coined in 1808. The booming development of the railway system in the 1800s occurred alongside the Industrial Revolution and expedited everything, including construction-related injuries due to a variety of disasters. Railway construction workers exposed to such disasters began reporting symptoms associated with hysteria, and the possibility of nerve damage was raised as a potential cause. This became a critical point of contention as the railway corporations were potentially tasked with new liabilities that they had no interest in covering. Thereafter, Kierkegaard completed the first full exposition on anxiety in the same year that Lotz published the first formal text addressing mental health as part of medical efforts. The year 1861 brought about what may be one of the most monumental and under-celebrated achievements related to mental health. Specifically, Paul Broca identified an area of the brain dedicated to an observable behavior, articulated speech, and in doing so undermined Cartesian dualism by providing a tangible link between the material and the mental worlds. 1861 also heralded the start of the American Civil War. Through the course of the war, an increasing number of soldiers reported a common cluster of physiological symptoms with no identifiable explanatory physical abnormalities. The symptoms appeared to arise after protracted exposure to combat, combined with overexertion, deficient rest, and deficient nourishment. The symptoms were presupposed to result from excess dilation of the heart, causing irritation. The symptoms were also classified as neurasthenia by Baird in 1869, who identified the overlap with hysteria symptoms. It wasn't until 1879 that Wundt opened his historic laboratory for conducting the first experiments to study psychology with scientific methods. Only 3 years later, the French Academy of Science approved Charcot's hypnosis therapy for treating hysteria, providing a sanctioned treatment beyond biology for the increasingly pervasive disorder. Freud would study hypnosis under Charcot, and during that time developed the talking cure as an alternative treatment for hysteria. The talking cure, based on his famous work with patient Anna Oh, included a premise that that traumatic memories had been repressed by the mind, and the repression was creating symptoms of hysteria. Freud's talking cure initially involved allowing the patient to speak freely about whatever came to mind, while the therapist asked probing questions to uncover the repressed traumas. Following the establishment of the APA in 1892, there was increasingly broad interest in neuroses subsequent to traumatic exposures, and, more generally, following exposure to any fear-inducing event. By the start of the Boer War, hysteria and neurasthenia had become increasingly common diagnoses, with the most dramatic symptoms involving conversion disorder, wherein various paralyses would occur in the absence of neurological damage. There was still significant stigma towards mental health in the general population, with people believing mental health problems were biologically driven, heritable, and a sign of poor genetics. Hysteria was more often the diagnosis provided to women. It was considered psychological, but a function of poor genetics and still carried social stigma. In contrast, neurasthenia was more often the diagnosis provided to wealthy persons and heroic men, considered biomechanical, but a function of the nerves being overwhelmed to the point of exhaustion, and it did not carry the same social stigma. Mental health malingering would have been almost unheard of before 1914. Mental health was persecuted in social circles, with sufferers and their families being ostracized as well as saddled with insufficient treatment options that came at huge expense. Mental health concerns, feigned or not, offered nothing for an individual to gain and everything for that individual to lose. The theories for hysteria focused primarily on heritable factors underlying fragile nerves with sexist and racist biases, all of which allowed the individual to be blamed and held accountable for their symptoms. In contrast, neurasthenia, the result of overwhelming traumatic exposure, allowed the circumstances to be blamed, making it much easier to exonerate the individual. Freud and Watson began to argue that such distinctions were unsupported and emphasized instead the importance of individual experiences on the developing mental health. By 1914, there were a variety of treatments being employed for hysteria and neurasthenia. The treatments varied from biomechanical to psychological to applications of radiation. Treatment providers touted changes in diet, narcotic use, alcohol use, and a host of salves, ointments, and solutions with dubious scientific bases. The treatments were all met with a variety of supports and criticisms, with perhaps the most dramatic treatment being electroshock. Electroshock therapy was first designed to re-energize the nerves and followed recent discoveries around bioelectric signals. The idea was that the nerves had in fact been drained of their energy and required more energy to proceed. Later, it was used as a test for malingering in conversion disorder. However, the therapy was actively discredited by Freud. The early 1900s also brought about rapid development of intelligence research, driven by economic and political forces, as well as the very first modern structured intelligence test. Furthermore, 1914 brought about the BMA publicly denouncing pseudoscience and raising the bar for medicines and treatments, including those for hysteria and neurasthenia. Of course, 1914 was also the start of World War I, which should be and would be a very different kind of war. The Great War involved new kinds of combat, faster kinds of killing, an impersonal kind of death on a scale unlike anything the world had ever seen before. Death was waiting around every corner for soldiers, from exploding shells of shrapnel, to hidden mines, to long-distance snipers, to aerial bombings, to chemical toxins. Despite the new and varied methods developed for killing, advances in medicines and health technologies, driven by necessity and readily available research, allowed unprecedented numbers of combatants to survive, though many would carry the injuries of the war for the rest of their lives. Advances in technologies, social sciences, and communications also meant concurrent advances for health research and patient advocacy. The war produced historic numbers of people who, having returned from combat deployment, reported significant difficulties with anxiety, depression, and substantial neurological disorders. The impact of traumatic exposure could no longer be dismissed, and veterans and the public began to demand something be done. The infamous phrase shell shock was coined very initially not by health professionals, but by the military members themselves. It stemmed from notions that exposure to the shells were causing physical damage that resulted in psychological symptoms. The symptoms themselves were poorly defined at first, but sounded very much like hysteria or neurasthenia. I want to show you this 2-minute video displaying some of the varied symptoms from World War I. You can see here a soldier confined to a wheelchair by what appears to be conversion disorder, who is being attended by a nurse. The treating physician is about to use great force, to no avail, to try and get the treated soldier to be able to successfully bend his foot at the ankle. As you can see, he does so, with the soldier taking negligible note at all of the rather substantial force being applied to that relatively weaker joint. The recorded symptoms do share some overlap with modern post-traumatic stress, including heightened startle response, as we'll see here shortly, avoidance behaviors, numbing, dissociation, as well as flattened affect or depressed mood. In this case, the simple mention of the word bombs causes the patient to have a panic attack, one that could have easily been detected by ECG of the day, and dive underneath the bed for cover. The symptoms of the day also included high levels of conversion disorder, something not typically associated with what we consistently refer to as post-traumatic stress disorder in modern day. That said, in hindsight, we're able to see interactive cultural influences on mental health that we only get the benefit of by 100 years worth of looking. At the time, there would have been insufficient experience to understand the complex interactions that they were seeing between biology, environment, and experience, all of which were driving, producing, and supporting the symptoms. Many of the patients were able to benefit from hypnosis therapy, wherein their symptoms could be brought under control. However, hypnosis was relatively rarely provided at the time, and more patients than not ended up simply confined to psychiatric wards. Designating a formal diagnosis for symptoms was met with tremendous resistance. There were long-standing biases that mental health problems were the result of poor genetic stock. The military and political leaders were concerned that such a diagnosis could critically reduce the number of available soldiers for World War I, as well as incur tremendous financial liabilities for treatment and pensions, liabilities for which there were insufficient resources. There were also growing concerns about professional boundaries, as physicians were unable to create objective tests for such a diagnosis, nor reliable and cost-effective treatments. The military leaders of the day took a strong and early stance against recognizing post-trauma responses, designated as shell shock, as being anything but weakness, cowardice, and a failure of manhood. Only those with real physical injuries and not imagined injuries could claim to be distressed. All others were cowards, to be condemned and shamed, a practice still used today by a fortunately falling number of ignorant persons. Military and political leaders alike condemned the notion that any soldier should be rewarded in any way for changes to their mind as a result of the war, for such changes were considered nothing but a manifestation of weakness that was inherent to the person. In spite of the challenges and the controversies, shell shock became a diagnosis amongst a variety of others. That said, the diagnosis of shell shock was hardly accepted outright. Persons with a shell concussion or shell shock symptoms that could be directly and easily tied to enemy exposure were designated with a W and given a wounded stripe, which was a badge of honor. In all other cases, persons exhibiting such symptoms were designated with an S, which was dishonorable, and excluded them from accessing care or pensions. Unfortunately, the physicians of the day reported it was very difficult to definitively distinguish who should receive a W and who should receive an S, and there was a tremendous amount of pressure to avoid assigning W. Indeed, the physicians were bothered terribly by the difficulties in distinguishing W and S patients, and in their journals wrote language that clearly evidences their own difficulties as first responders interacting with the traumata. After 1914, the social, political, economic, and military demands had created tremendous pressure to keep soldiers active in the war and to disclaim notions of financial liability wherever possible. The often invisible nature of mental health disorders made them an easy target because of the established social stigma in a highly masculinized culture. There was an active campaign to stigmatize the realities of post-traumatic stress disorder and mental health. The social stigma was worse because it was yoked to cowardice, and treatments, effective or not, were nascent and rare. The practitioners of the day quickly realized the value of early diagnosis and intervention, but treatment evidence was still many years away, and preferred treatments were based on expense, availability, and cultural biases, with psychological interventions considered the last resort because of the related expense and the relatively obscure nature of expert practitioners. In most cases, the available treatments involved ardent attempts to instill more masculinity and rid the sufferers of the presupposed childishness and feminine weaknesses that allowed them to succumb to shell shock in the first place. The magnitude of the mental health challenge, though, led to initial attempts to screen out persons likely to develop post-traumatic symptoms. The recent advances in IQ testing were then brokered for such purposes. However, the need for mass screenings of literate and illiterate persons demanded the creation of tools that could be administered in large groups and with nonverbal content. Those tests formed the basis for all IQ tests that followed and propagated the popularity of intelligence testing. However, the practice also propagated notions that intelligence was almost entirely heritable. The first test was called Army Alpha and involved language and problem skills. The second test was called Army Beta and contained content that would still be entirely familiar to modern psychologists everywhere. Similarly, researchers began exploring whether personality could predict who would develop post-traumatic stress symptoms. The Woodworth test was designed exclusively for that purpose and, while not deployed in time and seemingly entirely unable to discriminate between those who would and would not develop symptoms, it was accepted as a preliminary screen for future use by the Surgeon General. The Woodworth test would form the basis for almost all personality tests that followed, with some items still used directly today. The test informed not only content, but also testing methods, such as using reverse-worded items to guard against response apathy. Some questions appeared relevant, some arbitrary, but all were based on the best guess of the researchers at the time. Freud is often insufficiently recognized for his advocacy for the Great War soldiers. He argued passionately that shell shock was not biological, not inherent, and not a function of weakness. Although his advocacy did not bring a cascade change in the military, or the public perception of shell shock, or mental health, his pioneering efforts did lay critical foundations for what we now see as the mental health renaissance in the 21st century. By the end of World War I, the health community was well aware that the symptoms associated with shell shock were unrelated to shelling, unrelated to physical shock, and unrelated to physical damage. There was a general acceptance that the responses were psychological and the result of traumatic exposure. Unfortunately, that made the stigma worse, as did the growingly stark professional boundaries being drawn between physical and mental health professions. Despite the growing evidence against Cartesian dualism, the pejorative, materialistic, biological, heritable views of mental health were now pervasively established amongst the public, and accusations of malingering had become commonplace. Theory and propaganda had become fact. The false distinction between real and imagined symptoms had taken hold and continues today. By World War II, combat stress reaction would replace shell shock as the label for post-traumatic symptoms. The rates of diagnoses varied by exposure level from 10% to 100%. Worse yet, the lessons from World War I had to be relearned, and it took years to reinstate early assessments and interventions for the symptoms. Having recalled, though, the lessons from World War I, the researchers were able to identify relatively quickly timelines before combat stress reaction would set in. Specifically, 100% of persons would become symptomatic after 240 days of combat exposure. This represented a significant departure from the biological ideology to an environmentally based one when considering mental health. Combat stress reaction continued to unfold during the Korean and the Vietnam Wars, as did our understanding of and interactions with mental health and the associated complications. The first fully formalized and broadly accepted recognition of the psychological impact of traumatic exposure began in 1952, when the Psychiatric Diagnostic Manual, in its first edition, included gross stress reaction as a viable diagnosis independent of other diagnoses. The diagnosis was removed before the second edition was published in 1968, likely due to insufficient advocacy and a pressure to minimize disorders. PTSD was finally included formally in DSM-3. However, the inclusion required stunning advocacy from grassroots organizations, including psychologists, psychiatrists, veterans, and public supporters of veterans. The required effort to get PTSD recognized and included underscores the critical socio-political nature of mental health, but also the long reach of intentional and arguably necessary biases against recognizing PTSD, biases that became massive and pervasive to support the war efforts from 1914 to 1918. The details of the PTSD diagnosis continued to change, largely with a focus on what kind of trauma or trauma response would be recognized as sufficiently stressful to warrant the diagnosis, coupled with relatively minor changes to the specific symptom patterns. In the most recent edition, DSM-5, the discussion regarding what constitutes exposure to a traumatic event continues. The symptom clusters have been thoroughly clarified and refined. The research base and social supports are now such that it has become highly unlikely PTSD will be removed from any future DSM. We have come a great distance since the Great War, and we have done so at great cost. There is now increasing advocacy for awareness, education, and the reduction of stigma for mental health. The recent social and political advances in PTSD have largely been the result of persistent advocacy coupled with increases in our willingness and ability to communicate with one another. Advances in PTSD have also supported pervasive advances in mental health, brokered in no small part on the dramatically publicized symptoms of some few military and first responders who have fallen under the massive weight of the sacrifices we have asked of them. Remember, by the end of World War II, we already knew 240 days of exposure to trauma was too long for anyone to stave off symptoms. Just imagine 25 years as a modern first responder. The impact of World War I on mental health has been profound and is still felt today in very direct, very real ways. The demands of the Great War forced mental health realities to be intentionally undermined, while simultaneously forcing advancements in assessment and treatment to meet the growing mental health needs of an embattled generation. The double-edged sword created a tremendous surge in research and development, but also proliferated the pervasive stigma and ignorance that has plagued mental health for a century. It may be that it was necessary to hide the truth about trauma and mental health in order to win World War I, but it is certainly not necessary now. Ironically, managing the mental health calamity may have also forced a renaissance in mental health. However, we are still paying for the victories, the losses, the advances. These are payments made in blood by those who protect us, who are now more likely to die at their own hand than they are in service. We knew then, and we most certainly know now, we need to banish ignorant ideas about mental health and build on the lessons from the Great War and beyond. We need to end the stigma. We need to raise advocacy. We need to do the costly and time-consuming research that we have skirted for the past 100 years. We need to provide adequate support for our military and for our first responders. And so the question I leave you with tonight is this: how much longer will we ask them to stand on guard for us before we will stand on guard for them? Thank you very much for your attention and your support for all those who serve.